This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, we'll take you on a local antique roadshow. The music community is mourning the loss of one of their leaders. We're going back to basics with Seeds of Resistance. There is a new spin on catalog gifting. An opera singer dials in with a razor-sharp wit. The police are keeping their cards close to their chest about the federal buyback program. And Nova Scotia Power is on the hot seat after a Russian-based cyber attack back in April. These stories are coming up on the Coast.
The 6-week pilot test program wrapped up 2 weeks ago. The program urged local gun owners to turn in weapons that have been marked prohibited by the federal government 5 years ago. Regional Police Chief Robert Walsh spoke in Ottawa about their excitement to be involved in the pilot program, but their involvement drew criticism from gun-owning citizens, many of whom chose to protest the pilot program outside the regional police headquarters in Sydney in October. However, now that the pilot program has ended, both the regional police and federal government have gone silent on the program they had championed. Following a meeting of the Cape Breton Regional Municipality Police Commission, Walsh was asked about the results of the program, but refused to discuss them.
Anything in relation to the pilot is a matter of the federal government. You'd have to direct your inquiries to them. I'm not at liberty to discuss the project because it's the federal government's project. So everything in relation to that, you'll have to ask them.
He said he had been directed by the feds not to discuss the results. Coast 89.7 News reached out to the Department of Public Safety, who were in charge of the project, but did not receive a response. However, the chair of the CBRM Police Commission, District 6 Councillor Glenn Perouche, was able to offer some insight into the results of the pilot program.
I've heard that they did have some success, but I didn't get a total number on the guns. Unofficially, I heard that there was 10 to 22 collected. It tells me that there are some people out there that wanted to pass in guns. What it says for the potential project itself, I honestly can't comment on that until I talk to the chief and get the actual numbers on it.
He discussed bringing the discussion on the program's numbers to the commission.
In hindsight, it definitely could have been something that we added to the agenda just to get a comment from the chief. So it could be something that we could see on the December agenda if that's what the general public want on there. That's, we can make that happen.
He also spoke about the public's interest in the program.
I'm getting some questions from people. I've gotten more emails on what the numbers were. So yeah, definitely we'll see if we can get the proper comments.
Meanwhile, critics of the program are reacting to the unofficial number of weapons turned in. Anna Manley is a lawyer, business owner, legal gun owner, and was the candidate of record for the Conservative Party of Canada in the Sydney-Glace Bay riding in the last federal election. Manley has been vocal about her opposition to the pilot program and shared her reaction to the silence from regional police and the unofficial number of weapons turned in.
I'm not surprised that the federal government told them not to talk about it at all. I'm very proud of our island and the firearms community here that not more people turned in their guns. If it ended up being 10 guns, I am incredibly proud.
Manley says she wants to see the program dropped entirely and more focus on illegal firearms coming from the United States. Manley's comments were echoed by the Port Morian Wildlife Association, who have also been vocally opposed to the gun buyback program.
Cape Breton Regional Police are investigating several recent reports of intimate partner violence. The police recently arrested a 40-year-old Sydney Mines man accused of murder after the death of a woman who called for help. Constable Gary Fraser says domestic violent calls are among the most received at their department.
There is a lot of intimate partner domestic violence here. We have a lot of alcohol-related stuff, drug-related stuff, and thefts, and we do have an abundance of the domestic-related stuff also.
Frazier says police are especially alert when responding to intimate partner violence calls because people can have a change of heart after calling 911.
It's one of the worst calls we could get because when we entered the home, and normally the aggressor is the male. So when we identify the aggressor, and a lot of times it's female, but mostly it's male, and we have, and I have on instance, had the victim turn on the police while we're there trying to ascertain what happened. So it could get really violent for the police at any given time. So I've seen a lot of domestic related calls and a lot of things go sideways while we're there. Whether the victim is a male or female or the aggressive person is a male or female, it's not a good mix for the police to be in at that time when there's violence on both sides.
Frazier was asked why he believes victims change their mind when the police arrive to arrest their partner accused of violence.
It's hard to say. I couldn't even explain what's going through their minds at the time. But I've seen on many, many times, the policing for 35 years, I've seen a lot of domestic related calls and a lot of things go sideways while we're there on the call.
Frazier says it's difficult for some people to leave an unhealthy relationship.
And you know, that's the question we as police ask the victims, like, well, why did it take so long to report this? We want them to report it right away, make sure we're aware of it. And a lot of times we have victims saying, well, I love the person. I think that person will change. But if it continues and it perpetuates, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse. If they're slapping you today, they could be punching you tomorrow. So we want them to report it right away if it's, you know, the first time it happens, and get some help. There's so much out there. You got the Every Woman's Shelter. You got the Transition House. You got Jane Paul. There's so much out there for victims of family violence. And they should utilize it.
And there is also a national telephone number available. It's 1-888-709-7090. Donna McGregor is officially in post-production on her new show, Antiques and Aspirations. The show title shares a name with her Cabot Trail shop, and Dialogues Cora Perrigo speaks to her about what it's like taking her passion for antiques on the road, as well as the porcelain horse that started it all.
What got you into antiques?
When I was a kid, I started poking around a bottle dump, a place where prior to the creation of a centralized dump, people used to toss their junk in piles around their homesteads, and it was usually a ravine or in a pile in a field. And I happened to have one of those close to where I grew up, and one day when I was poking through it, I found a porcelain horse ornament. And like most little girls at the time, I was crazy about horses. So when there also happened to be a neighborhood antique dealer at the time, and she used to go around to the local houses looking to see if anyone had anything to sell from their attics. And while my mom was having a look for something, I offered to show her my ornament. And the antique dealer looked at the stamp on the bottom and raised an eyebrow, and she asked if I knew what the stamp meant. It said, Made in Occupied Japan, and I was only seven or so I really didn't know what it meant. And she explained that it was made during the time between 1945 and 52, I think it was, when after World War II, the Allied forces were occupying Japan. And as a kid, it was a little bit over my head, but I thought it was interesting. She asked me where I had gotten the ornament, and I told her about the bottle dump. And she laughed and told me that I might just end up being an antique dealer, because apparently that's something that people who really love antiques start doing. And while I didn't expect to become a dealer, I was certainly hooked on the idea that there could be such interesting stories attached to items. So that was kind of what kicked it off.
Does that kind of keep you coming back, these pieces of history, like the interesting stories?
Absolutely. There's so much to learn, even things that you're not going to charge a lot for, say, an old medicine bottle, but it's Aqua Blue and people like that. But sometimes if there's a name embossed on it and you look into the history of that particular company name, you learn really interesting bits. Like one time I found a bottle and I went down the rabbit hole, and it turned out he had actually not only been making medicine, but he ended up creating the first American university that allowed females to become medical students.
And I know you said you, the childhood story about, you might become an antiques dealer. I believe you have an antique shop, correct?
I do. It's located on Hunter's Mountain, 460 Cabot Trail, and I'm open all year round on weekends. It's about 10 minutes westerly direction of Bedeque, right in the heart of Cape Breton. It's a lovely little spot. And I actually have a full-time job, so I'm only open on weekends. But I've got a Facebook page that has albums full of the items I have for sale, and it's updated regularly with new stuff and the old stuff marked sold or whatever. And people can contact me through that Facebook page as well.
Is that, I guess, kind of how the show came about?
It is. It came about because I'm fortunate enough to hang out with some really creative people, two of whom actually have a company called Spectra 71 Films. And we frequently, over the years, bounce ideas off each other for business or creative endeavors. Sometimes we're serious, sometimes we're not. And I've helped or played bit parts in some of their other film and theater works, and they've listened to me tell stories for years about the fascinating people I deal with in my business and some of the amazing things I get to see. And then last winter, a story they heard particularly intrigued them, so they asked if I would consider hosting a show. 5 years ago, I probably would have said no, but this year I actually said yes, and the seed was planted.
So what kind of is the premise of the show?
The premise of the show is it takes people into the life of an antique dealer, basically. They follow me around to see what I do and who I see when I'm out buying and selling for my shop. And while the viewers will see some really cool items, the show focuses as well on the interesting people that populate the world of antiques. So it runs the gamut between people who sell things to me, people who are frequent buyers, other dealers, auctioneers, people who have special and related skills. It's about relationships and perspectives and personalities. It's not a valuation show, which that's the formula that most antique shows are based on. So that's not what we're about. It's about the people and the things I find interesting and the people that have helped me to develop my business and people that love old stuff as much as I do and people who do fabulous things with old stuff.
And can you tell us about any of the people you've met along the way?
Well, in this particular series of episodes, I'm going to deal with a couple of people who are very avid collectors. And one lady, it's like she is the keeper of all of the genealogy records of a particular family. She's got stuff dating back hundreds of years, and it's all connected to one family. Another lady is a younger person, and she is a crafter and an artisan herself, and she uses old things to repurpose and to create artwork that she also uses to make a living. There are people who have their own shops, and some of the people will be familiar with them. There are musical personalities, and there's a few surprises thrown in, too.
Can you share anything about when your show will air or where it will air?
Well, we're currently in post-production, and that's being done by Spectra 71 Films here in Cape Breton. And we're scheduled to deliver the show to 5 TV in the spring, and then 5 will determine when the release date will be, and then they'll tell us, and of course we're going to spread the word far and wide, and that'll happen through our social media pages like the Facebook group, Instagram. Cape Breton Film is our production company, so they are... they have a Facebook and Instagram page as well. we've got a lot of local talent on our production team, and they all live in Cape Breton, so it's a very community-oriented type thing. And I had chosen to spotlight other small businesses because we're all about community. None of us exist in a vacuum, and each of the folks that show up in these segments assisted me in my business in some way. We're all interconnected, basically, because of the common denominator is antique, vintage, retro things. So creating the show has been the biggest act of reciprocity that I could possibly offer the people who have showed up for me and still show up. And the antiques world is full of such interesting characters. I could have had so many different people on, but we're only allotted so much time.
And is this kind of anything you ever saw yourself doing?
It really isn't. When I was a kid, well, not a kid, but a younger person, first moving into my own home and filling it with these very odd things, people used to joke and said I was going to end up on the show of Weird Homes, which was a show that aired in the 1980s, I guess it was, and now it just seems bizarre that instead of being on Weird Homes, I'm kind of hosting it.
Where do you hope this kind of takes you in the future?
Well, I started buying and selling as a way to, first of all, upkeep my own habit. And then I realized by making some money with it, and I have a style that things that I pick and curate, other people really enjoy. So it's been helpful to help pay bills along with my regular job. And at some point, I'd like to retire from the regular job and make this my full-time thing in retirement. Although, if there's more stuff come up with Spectra 71 films and Cape Breton films, I've really enjoyed the process. We had such a great team on the road that, and learning about the how things come together and the amount of work that's involved, it's been fascinating.
And eventually, when it does go to air, what do you hope people take away from it?
Well, I think people will be intrigued, first of all, by the items that we're going to show. Certainly the people are interesting. Everyone's got a story to tell, of course, and some items, just like my little horse ornament, it had a story, and other items have stories. And people collect for so many different reasons. It's hard not to get caught up in the passion of why people collect what they do and how they use them. So it's been quite interesting.
And where can people find more information? I know you said you had a Facebook page.
I have a Facebook page that's also my, basically my sales page. It's called Donna McGregor Antiques and Aspirations. I don't keep up very well on my Instagram page because there's only one of me and so much to do. But Cape Breton Film also has a Facebook page and probably, yes, an Instagram page as well. So either of those spots.
And is there anything you'd like to add?
Well, I should give a shout-out to some of the people I worked with. Vivian Zound, who is also the director and co-writer and producer. She's also the sound lady. She's a dynamo. I had never imagined that it required so much organization to get this kind of thing all together. And when she and I brainstormed the idea, she got together with our executive producer, who is also our cinematographer and editor, by the way, Patrick Langteau, and he was the one that created a lookbook to pitch to Five TV, and they liked it enough to pick it up. So then they worked with Cape Breton Film and brought in this really diverse group of people. It was a great team. We worked for 15 days together and had a lot of laughs, and it was just a really great experience.
The Coast Morning Show host Bill Bradley is up next with a talented artist who as a child started singing in a choir in a Baptist church where her father was a deacon.
She studied voice and piano from the age of 7, and as a teenager, she took voice lessons in her hometown and spent summers on scholarship at the Boston Conservatory, and she was nominated twice for Juno Awards before she won, actually, back in 2008. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Canadian soprano Misha Brueger-Gosman-Lee. Welcome to the program.
Well, Bill, I'm so thrilled with the pronunciation of my name, brother. Good job.
Okay, because I know a lot of people screw that up. And you know what? I practice that. I will tell you because I'm thinking, this is a hard name to say, but I got it right.
And the Lee, of course, you know I married a caper. So
yeah,
I found someone with the shortest last name that I could possibly find. I was like, I nabbed him right up. My new Waterford.
So your husband's from New Waterford?
He's my new Waterford hotness.
Yeah, there you see, you're even saying it right. It's, you get people from away, as I call them, New Waterford. No, it's New Waterford.
Exactly. I've heard him say it so many times, and I love my Cape Breton family.
So does your husband have a Cape Breton accent?
I mean, I can't tell. I think when he speaks to other capers, he definitely has it, a little thicker.
Yeah.
But he cleans it up for us.
You and I were chatting off air, and many, many years ago, I started my radio career and went to broadcasting in Ontario Loyalist College. And funny how we're talking about accents. I thought I was doing great until I was at college and nobody knew where I was from and thought, okay, I'm doing good here. They think that I'm actually from Ontario or somebody from Ontario. And then when I said, instead of saying ice, I said oice.
Got little tells that reveal where we've been, eh?
There you go. But enough about me. Let's talk about you. This is going to be an exciting show. It's coming up at the CBU Boardmore Playhouse featuring Aaron Davis, Mike Edward, and your husband, Steve Lee, right?
That's right.
Yeah.
I like to bring Steven home as much as I possibly can. And, you know, there is a plan afoot to add another show, so if people hear this and add tickets, it could be that we're on Cape Breton a little bit longer.
With that being said, before you actually perform, is the first stop into Waterford?
Yes, and I have to bring a couple of my musicians are coming from away.
Okay.
So I have to take Aaron and Mike. Michael Eckert is our pedal steel player. So
okay.
It's really great to bring pedal steel and that sound onto a concert. It's a very incredible instrument to work with, and I'm super excited about it. But they don't know much for the Cape Breton. So I have to bring them over a little bit early to, like, make sure that they can acclimatize, right? So they're like, yes, things move a little slower. We can enjoy our time. Yes, that smell is fresh air.
Exactly.
Coming from Toronto.
Exactly, yes. And you've been in Toronto for a while there and, of course, originally from New Brunswick. But as that story goes, you've been everywhere, all around the world, and you'll get to come here and smell that fresh air coming up.
Oh, my goodness. God has been so good. We started in Toronto, moved to Germany, all for studying singing and music, but really we found our home here in the Annapolis Valley, and you know, my 10-year-old and my 13-year-old, they only know Nova Scotia. We've been here 12 years. Yeah.
Wow. So being in the Annapolis Valley, how many apples have you eaten?
I mean, how much cider have I drunk?
Okay.
Let's be clear.
All right.
I put those apples to good use.
All right. So let's talk about your show coming up. Now, you started singing at the age of 7. Did you know then what you were actually getting into, and fast forward all these years later?
Yeah, no, I definitely did. And my parents were never like, oh, the risky business of class. Like, I had no idea how risky my career was because my parents were so sure that that was what God had called me to do. So it's like, you know, ways are made for giftings. Like, that's sort of how I was raised. So I just forged forward, did my best to be excellent, and then all of a sudden I have, like, this 41 years behind me of singing, and I'm not going to be fake and say I've loved every minute of it because
no.
It's really kicked my butt a lot,
mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't recommend it for people who have other options, but
no.
I love it.
So nice to chat with you, and again, the show coming up on Saturday, December 6th, 7:30, the CBU Boardmore Playhouse. Tickets are available online at rockthefiddleevents.com. Knock him dead, I know you will.
Oh, thank you, Bill. Have a great day.
Thank you.
MLAs pressed Nova Scotia Power at a special committee meeting about customers receiving power bills up to three times more than expected. NSP CEO Peter Gregg says the utility started estimating bills after an April Russian-based cyber breach that destroyed the system between billing and reading meters. He said about 75% of the meters have now been physically read, meaning about 25% or 100,000 customers are now receiving bills based on estimated power usage. NDP leader Claudia Chender said an Energy Department representative should have been present at the committee meeting, and then she reads from a report suggesting the province can do a better job as a regulator.
Houston government have done nothing to address the situation despite a program recommended by the Energy Poverty Task Force more than a year ago. And then they play politics and use Nova Scotia Power as their boogeyman. People are understandably angry with Nova Scotia Power, but we need to also expect solutions from our government.
Liberal MLA Ian Rankin asked Gregg if the power utility will commit to revealing what will happen with the revenue collected from overbilling.
Yes, we can commit to that. The broad commitment is to all of our customers, back to we'll get it right, we'll fix it. We will true up all these bills. And so once we're able to get the true meter reads and the communication system back up and running, we can do that. I don't want anyone to think that we're just taking that money. If people have overpaid, we owe people back that money, and we will give them back that money.
The utility says it will not charge late fees or interest to customers dealing with an estimated bill. However, PC MLA Kyle McCrory says many customers feel stalled when they have financial uncertainties.
They get an estimated bill. They have to continue to plan their life, and they don't know. They might get a high bill, higher than normal. It may be an overestimate or an underestimate, and they don't know. And they need to continue to plan their life as they go forward. What can you do to help advise them as they go through the future if their bill is overestimated or underestimated? Because they need to make plans now in order to be able to go through that process.
Responding to that, Chris Lantang is in charge of Nova Scotia Power customer care.
Yeah, and a very, very fair question, and I agree with you on an individual customer level. That's what's important to an individual Nova Scotian. I think for me, the few things that are available for those customers is, again, understanding what's driving the bill. I mentioned earlier, it will indicate if the meter has been read. If the bill has been estimated and a customer has that particular concern, we want to talk to them. We want to help them out. And there is a process. If they talk to us again, alluded to it earlier, you know, we can help prioritize meter readings for those customers. But also they have a process now that we have made more proactive where they could submit a photo of the reader of the meter, excuse me, so that we can actually reconcile the bill with the actual usage in their home. So those are some of the options that are available to them to support them. And again, fully recognize the fact that, you know, people want to pay their bills and they want to make sure that they're caught up on everything.
Nova Scotia Power says it plans to start restoring the billing system next month and they hope to have it fixed by March. One of Cape Breton's best-known music festivals is turning a page with one of its leaders retiring and another one sadly passing away. Co-founder Joella Folds worked with Dan McDonald prior to and during many years of the Celtic Colors International Festival. Folds and the music community are mourning the death of McDonald, who recently passed away.
I say that Dan was a really special, unique person. He was very hardworking and very dedicated to music on Cape Breton Island, and extremely knowledgeable and willing to share all that knowledge. In fact, he was kind of our encyclopedia about a lot of things, particularly around genealogy and who was connected to who and who played with who and all that sort of thing. And he was just a lovely person. He was a great guy. And I loved working with him.
She says Dan worked with her and co-founder Max McDonald, and they all learned from each other.
So we were doing artist management and booking and that sort of thing before Celtic Colors. We learned together a lot about what was available in terms of, talent, but also venues and the opportunities for our artists to get out there. And so, you know, he was part of the early planning for Celtic Colors and was part of our team for a number of years.
For the past 30 years or so, the Celtic Colors International Festival has featured some of the best local talent at venues all over Cape Breton. Fold says it continued to pick up momentum over the years.
It seems surprising when you look back, but in the process, it was sort of one step at a time. And we would learn from the year before and try to do things better. And so when you look back on it, it's been a huge impact, and we're really pleased with that. And I guess we never really expected anything of this magnitude to happen, even though in the very earliest days, the model was the same. Shows all over the island in all the municipalities and so on. It's just sort of grown to the point where the Cape Breton communities feel it belongs to them, and I think that's really success in my books.
She says the success lies with the natural talent of the artist, as music runs deep in their DNA.
The natural passing of the culture has been always happening since, you know, people first came over from what they called the old country. But with things like the festival, it allows people and artists to up their game and to actually begin to tour other places. And so it has made Cape Breton not only well known around the world, but it has actually, I think, by bringing in all these international artists, it's added to the skills and the experience of our local artists who are now making a career of their music.
By the way, Joella retired again as artistic director on Friday.
I think it's been a privilege to come back and be a part of a sort of rebuilding year. Celtic Colors has had some struggles, and I was surprised to be asked to come back, but I have done my best to try to get things and help get things back on track, and it's been a real privilege to do that.
Fold says the festival's future is left in good hands.
Nobody should be concerned. Things are very much back on track. We have a fabulous board, and the management team that was set up by the interim board was extremely competent and did a great job. They've now hired Sean Walters and Wendy McIsaac to be co-artistic directors, both of whom have a lot of experience. And so I think nobody should be worrying about Celtic Colors. It's going forward in a very good way.
She says even though she's retiring, she isn't saying goodbye for good.
Oh, I'm always here. Every year I have volunteered. So I'm never far from Celtic Colors. And I've told them that if they need me for anything, I'm not going anywhere.
Next year will mark the 30th anniversary of the Celtic Colors International Festival. You may have heard about some exhibitions from local curator Haley Storm at places like North Sydney's The Cellar over the past couple of years, but now she has gone from DIYs and basements to a part in the new emerging curator program with the Center for Craft and Design. Dialogue's Cora Perrigo speaks to her about her exhibition, Seeds of Resistance, and how we all could benefit from getting back to basics.
And kind of what was the inspiration behind the exhibit?
The inspiration for the exhibition kind of came from my love of food, first and foremost. And secondly, just kind of, you know, exploring Cape Breton culture and, you know, things like that, and kind of having grown up around certain industries like farming and fishing specifically, and kind of, you know, seeing places like these food distribution centers pop up around and like organic food kind of becoming trendy and what that means in a community like ours, and, you know, how come organic produce and things like that is kind of on the uptrend, and what that means for just the regular peoples of our community.
And I know it was part of the Emerging Curators program, right?
Yeah, so the exhibition was part the first installment of Cape Breton Center for Craft and Design's Emerging Curator program.
And how did you get involved with that?
So Cape Breton Center for Craft and Design, they are sponsored by TD for some of their programs and whatnot. And they put a call out, I believe, over last winter, kind of into the spring. And so I just applied and kind of shot in the dark, and I got accepted in. I do have a fair bit of freelance curatorial under my belt, but I think it was just kind of on a whim, I suppose.
And kind of with that, I know you did kind of more DIY ones. What's it like to curate something in this space that is specifically for art?
Yeah, so it was a really big shift from opposed to my freelance work. You know, like I said, my exhibitions I curate at the Cellar in North Sydney, and, you know, for just some friends of mine, like at their own personal studios. It was a really big jump to go institutional in a way that's solely for, you know, arts and artists alike. It was a lot to learn, but I think once, you know, as a freelance artist and curator, once you know it, it's something you'll never forget, because there's just so much behind the scenes work, like logistics and shipping and, you know, artist contracts and things like that. You know, it was a major, major shift, but, you know, it's like learning manual. Once you know how to gear down, you're good for the road for life, right? So.
And what can people expect when they walk into it?
So when you go to view the exhibition at Cape Breton Craft and Design, you can expect a lot of just kind of rawness, really. You know, it's kind of quick and not quick and to the point, but it kind of tells the story itself. You know, antique tables, blank spaces, and, you know, just some abstract paintings, and, you know, an ode to, you know, the cultures that once were and the new ones that are here now. It kind of tells the story of, you know, change and the future, and also history itself. So.
And I know when I was there, we were talking about the, you know, the desire to have these antique chairs and tables. What was kind of the inspiration behind that? I know you said kind of the food culture that we were in and now that we're what was kind of the desire to have those pieces specifically?
So for the antique pieces that I installed for the exhibition, I kind of wanted that to depict what once was, but also how things change, but things that work stay the same. You know, like people love antiques, and people, you know, they're always searching for the newest, in quote, mid-century modern, you know, piece that they can find at a thrift store or on Marketplace. But I think people forget why they look for that, because in an age of mass production and in an age of, you know, the newest is the best, it's people sometimes forget that what once was and the older things and the antiques that, you know, kind of stand the test of time. I think it really kind of makes us think back to, oh, gee, the simple things is how we got to where we are. And I think people are slowly starting to realize that, you know, we kind of are returning to that. So,
and it's interesting. There is kind of this, I mean, every piece has kind of this different story, this different message to it. But it's funny to see these almost nostalgic pieces or more traditional pieces, like the there's fish on like a drying rack, the table settings kind of contrasted with the like my personal favorite piece, the Nelson White piece. What can you say kind of about that contrast?
I think the contrast between all of that, I kind of wanted that to represent, you know, the duality of what our normals are as different people. You know, like my great granddad, for example, he was from Norway and, you know, he lived in Newfoundland. So we made the drawing rack specifically to kind of tell a little story about that. And as for the natural piece, you know, it's natural birch. We cut it down out back outside of our house. And brought it in, and just the contrast between the rawness of the drawing rack and the stories that holds for a lot of older generations, against the new, almost kitschy, you know, Christmas ornament style codfish. I think it kind of just, you know, it just shows a bit of, you know, modern against like what the new old is, if that makes sense.
And I think kind of in this time of like this terrifying political climate and, you know, the unsteady economy, everything with that, it's so interesting when you say kind of the new old, there's so many people looking to kind of bring back those kind of traditional methods or, you know, traditionally made things or antique items. Specifically, I find a lot in the kitchen or if, like, make, you know, learning, especially kind of, I guess, in any kind of time of uncertainty. Think back to the pandemic. Everybody was learning how to make sourdough bread. Mm-hmm. There's kind of this similar thing. I think now a lot of people are on social media apps learning how to, you know, like I said, learning those traditional food making and food preparation methods.
That's kind of what, you know, the purpose of the exhibition is to really touch on, you know, the three things across every corner of the globe that kind of just make us people, that the three things we share is food, craft, and community. And I, you know, like those three things can become just blatantly political within themselves. So I think in these trying times, number one, being together is an act of resistance, you know, because like with the pandemic and how so far apart we were, you know, and how we were glued to our phones, and we tried to connect, and we connected in these very inhuman, strange ways. I think now how, you know, as people, we it's human nature to want connection, like socializing and community. Like, you don't realize how much you need that as a person until you can't access it. So I think for food, craft, and community, and this exhibition, its purpose specifically is to kind of just let people slow down and, you know, rethink what it all meant for generations past, and, you know, what it can mean to us now as, you know, a modern age, and especially with, you know, what's going on in the world and the politically charged bits here and there. I think it's really important to realize that the tried and true, the flour, salt, and water is really all we need to come together.
And what would you say to someone who is considering going out to the exhibition? What kind of would you want them to take away from it?
I think what I'd like a viewer to take away from the exhibition is just to slow down. You know, I think in a world where everything is so fast-paced, you know, everything is I want the newest, I want the biggest, I want the bestest, kind of, you know. I think this exhibition is just kind of a nod to those who go to see it, to just reconsider what it is you want from what you're getting. You know, like, do you want something because, well, oh, gee, I want this, maybe my neighbors will come over to see it. And, you know, like, are you not just wanting it to have the connection with someone to come see your new toy? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I think it's really important that we slow down and just reconnect with community. You know, we have, I dare I say it, is these pesky iPhones, but, you know, we've never been so far apart as people as we are today, even though we have such close contact with everything all at once, all of the time with our phones. I think it's really important that, you know, we share food, we share the memories of the food, because, you know, I think it's really important to keep things alive, you know, from before and kind of just carry on, you know, because I think it's such a fast-paced world, and it's time that we just be, I suppose.
And can you share some more information about how people can view the exhibit?
Yeah, definitely. So the exhibition is at Cape Breton Center for Craft and Design on the third floor in the loft, and you can view it there. It's on from now until January 9th. And while you're there, there's, you know, when you're done viewing and things like that, you can also take part in a community interactive in installation there. We left some little cue cards, printed cue cards that you can leave your name and a recipe and the closing date. We're going to be doing a zine giveaway party with one of our artists, Cora. And yeah, so feel free to drop by, have a see there. It's open as long as the center is open.
It's the kind of catalog where instead of ordering gifts for yourself, friends, and family, you're the one doing the sending. The Coast 89.7's Jacob Hostewaite reports.
The Cape Breton Regional Hospital Foundation has released their annual Because You Care gift catalog. The catalog gives the public a chance to donate to support those receiving care at the Cape Breton Regional Hospital by funding transportation, necessities, comfort items, and more. The year's catalog was unveiled at Colburn Ford in Sydney. The Colburn Auto Group has partnered with the Hospital Foundation and committed $100,000 over 5 years for the catalog. They'll be matching the first $20,000 in donations. General Manager of Colburn, Grant Colburn, spoke about what the catalog means to them.
Because You Care catalog is so close to our hearts here at Colburn, through the commitment of the Colburn Cares social responsibility, we made this commitment of $100,000 over 5 years. We hope to inspire generosity and help strengthen healthcare here at home. We believe in giving back to the people who give so much to us. Healthcare touches so many people here in Cape Breton, and to support this catalog is our way of saying thank you to our customers, to our employees, and to everybody involved.
Caitlin McDonald is the manager of philanthropy for the Hospital Foundation and spoke about the impact the catalog has.
Our catalog has had a significant impact on healthcare. We are very hopeful that this year will be no different. Since launching, the catalog has seen over 1,800 gifts purchased by 811 individual donors, supporting 19 areas of care. One of the wonderful things about this catalog is that you can support every single floor of Cape Breton Regional Hospital, whether it's pediatrics, cancer care, emergency, mental health. There's gift options for all of those areas, and so many patients in need. This catalog has helped thousands of patients. Last year, our foundation was able to support 2,700 individual patients. It's a big number, and a number that actually does continue to grow right now.
This year's catalog is dedicated to Nadine Keller Wadden, a longtime supporter of the foundation, as well as a volunteer and champion of many community causes. She passed away in 2024. Her husband, Jeff, was at the unveiling of this year's catalog. He spoke about what it means to pay tribute to Nadine in this way.
You're really paying tribute to that person and what they meant and what they did and who they were. And any time that you can take that and turn that into something good, to me it's the greatest honor when you're not of this world anymore and you can still have an impact on it and still make such dramatic, positive change for other people that are here and needing it. That says a lot about that person.
He discussed other ways he's paying tribute to Nadine.
What we've done in her name is she was heavily involved with school comfort closets here in the community. And we now have renamed three of those comfort closets in her name. They're known now as Nadine's Comfort Closet. She was so heavily involved with those schools in clothing them for basic essentials like hats, gloves, hygiene products, even involved in school breakfast program, physically on site making those breakfasts. And now they're renamed in her name, and they now provide those that comfort, love, and caring for our kids that need it most in the community. The kids that aren't lucky enough to maybe have what they need to be their best. And if she's now a big part of helping those kids be positive, be successful. And that's how we're honoring her memory moving forward. So that's her side of how we pay tribute to her.
Wadden also honored his late daughter, Molly, who passed away in 2022 following a battle with cancer. Jeff and his family continue to honor her with Molly's Mission, which financially supports children battling critical illnesses through the support of donors.
Molly's Mission still, of course, supports those critically ill kids, just like herself. We said, I'm just Molly's Mission's caretaker. It was Molly's idea. She started it. She's the founder. I just help to keep the buses running on time to make things still happen that we can and she can be a part of helping those kids as well that need it the most.
Because You Care catalogs will be available at the Cape Breton Regional Hospital Foundation on their website and at Colburn Chrysler and Colburn Ford locations. Since the catalog was launched in 2018, over $303,000 has been raised.
That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for an interview on the program, send us an email to news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.